What does it mean to experience a deadly epidemic?
In recent months, people have struggled with this question, but it's not a new question. Welcome to Experiencing Epidemics podcast. We are Gaspar Jakovac,
Jorge Diaz Ceballos,
and Ian Hathaway, and we want to explore this question as historians by delving into personal narratives drawn from the long history of people's encounters with epidemics.
We do so thanks to the contributions of scholars based at the European University Institute and beyond.
This project is brought to you as part of the COVID-19 Knowledge Hub of the European University Institute. Enjoy the show.
Take licorice, anise seed, and fennel seed, all in very fine powder, an ounce and a half, of grains, long pepper, saffron, cinnamon, ginger, all of these in powder, an ounce. Put all these powders together, but not the sugar candy. Take 9 spoonfuls of running water against the stream, and spoonfuls of red vinegar, 2 spoonfuls of treacle of gin, seethe all these together, and skim it clean. And if the patient be aged, let him drink it blood warm, a child as hot as he can suffer it, and let him fast long after it. The first and principal preservative against the plague is wisely and carefully to govern himself to eschew such meats and drinks as may cause him to surfeit and may engender in him gross and evil humours, whereby a man may fall into a fever. Also, baths, stews, and much sweating open the pores of man's bodies, and maketh venomous air to enter and infect the same, and to corrupt the spiritual members, and destroy all the vital spirits in a man.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Experiencing Epidemics podcast. I'm Ian Hathaway. The citations you just heard describe remedies against disease that came from one of the most influential medical texts of the Middle Ages, John of Burgundy's Plague Tract. To put it in John's words, this text was
a treatise of medicines good against the pestilence divided into 3 parts, whereof the first declareth how a man should bear and keep himself in the time of the pestilence, that he fall not into the sad sickness. The second expresseth how the sickness cometh, and the third part showeth what medicines are good and fit to be used against this contagious disease.
Precisely. Thank you, Gaspar. Now, in our second episode, we already learned quite a bit about the structure and concerns of European medieval plague treatises. So, if you're interested in the topic, feel free to check out that episode as well. Today, we will instead focus on a more specific topic, the travels and transformations of John of Burgundy's tract. We know relatively little about John, except that he was sometimes called the Bearded, and that he introduced himself in writing as
a physician and professor in the art of medicine in the city of Liege.
He wrote his tract around 1365, during the first major plague outbreak after the Black Death, which had ravaged Europe between about 1346 and 1353. Today, many copies of this text survive in several European languages. Indeed, John's work circulated in both manuscript and printed forms centuries after the death of its author. To talk about the history of this tract, I am now happy to welcome Dr. Laurie Jones. Dr. Jones is a postdoctoral fellow and contract instructor in the Department of History at Carleton University and a sessional professor at the University of Ottawa. Her research focuses on the relationship between manuscript and printed editions of medical treatises, and she has published several articles addressing the works of John of Burgundy in particular. Dr. Jones, thank you so much for being here with us today and for sharing this source and your research with us.
Thank you, Ian. It's a real pleasure for me to talk to you about plague treatises, since I have to admit that they are one of my favorite undervalued and discarded historical sources in the history of disease.
Well, I'm sure that today we will have a chance to really explore how interesting these sources can be. And to jump right in, our text was written around 1365, but the extracts that we are listening to today actually come from a much later edition of the text, right? Could you tell us something about the history of this book?
Sure. As you noted, we believe that this tract was originally written in 1365 in Liege, because that's what the text itself says. The oldest copy that can be firmly dated, though, is found in a beautifully illuminated French version commissioned a few years later for France's King Charles V. We also know of several much plainer Latin and Hebrew copies that were made by scholars, noblemen, and physicians over the following decades in France and Belgium. And one later Dutch version was reprinted a number of times for almost 100 years. But really, what's far more interesting is the way that this tract took off in England and Scotland at the end of the 14th century. And in fact, that's where almost all of the surviving manuscript copies come from, some in Latin, some in English. Several of the earliest ones are found in medical collections that contain texts in French, Latin, and English. And this, of course, reflects both the circulation of knowledge and people across the English Channel and the Norman heritage of some of the English population. We can also trace the treatise to a wide range of owners, including physicians and surgeons, clerics and monastics, courtiers and politicians, householders and scholars. And what else is interesting is that the French king was not the only royal owner of this text. Margaret Beaufort, who was the mother of England's King Henry VII, also possessed her own deluxe edition. But most of the surviving copies appear to have been made for personal use and are pretty plain, although we also have a few that were produced commercially that are absolutely incredible in terms of the detail, illustration, and gilding that they contain. So these copies were meant, obviously, for high status owners and not just a monk working in an infirmary or a barber surgeon making his rounds. So we really see that there are so many copies of this tract that are in Europe to some extent, but mostly in England and Scotland. I've looked at almost all of the surviving copies of the tract and can say that none are identical. There were several significantly different versions of the treatise that circulated, but only one version ever appeared in print, and this was taken from a completely revised adaptation made by a Dominican friar towards the end of the 15th century. And then it completely dominated the print market in the 16th century. But this wasn't the end of John of Burgundy's tract either, though. We know that some manuscript copies were made of the treatise even after it began circulating in print. And these were often made by antiquarians who were interested in plague treatments of the past. But I recently uncovered two more versions of the treatise that were made in the late 16th or early 17th century, and these seem to be to have been done so that the writer could actually use the information. Given all of this, I feel pretty confident saying that no other plague tract enjoyed such a long and varied life as this one by John of Burgundy.
Interesting. So there seems to have been quite a market at many different levels for this text and maybe for others like it. But did people actually use the remedies we just heard about that were contained in these books? Or were the copies of John's tract simply nice objects intended to sit on a shelf?
Great question. My sense from the ones that I've looked at is that the beautifully illustrated ones probably did sit on a shelf to a large extent, but most of the other ones were actually used by people who wanted to know how to treat the plague. There were many anti-plague recipes circulating throughout Europe and the Middle East, so we can assume that at least some of them were actually used. And the funny thing is that very few of these recipes were created specifically for plague. Instead, they were well-known recipes that were repurposed for plague. Their ingredients might seem strange to us today, but each one was carefully selected for its medicinal properties, such as bringing down fevers or reducing swelling. Lifestyle advice, such as avoiding certain foods and not bathing too much, was based on humoral theory and the fear that eating the wrong food or opening the body's pores through hot bath water, for example, would make a person susceptible to corrupt air. And of course, what most people miss today when they read these recommendations is the basic advice to get enough sleep and exercise, to eat and drink moderately, and to avoid being around people who are ill, because all of that too was believed to keep people healthy. So I really do think that people were using these tracts in order to understand how to treat themselves and those around them.
Okay, so don't overindulge and exercise when possible. That sounds familiar. But not all of John's remedies are like this, right? I would actually like to take a moment and listen now to an extract describing a medical practice that was very common at John's times, but with which we are largely unfamiliar today. Bloodletting.
The first means, therefore, that had been thought the best and fittest means of remedy after the infection received by learned men in the secrets of nature and in physic is letting of blood in fitting and convenient places. If that any corrupt matter appear about the share and privy members, then it is an argument that the liver is infected, and then the party so infected must be let blood on the same side, in the vein that is betwixt the great toe and the next unto it, and in no wise let him bleed in the arm, for that would draw up the infection again into the liver, and so to the heart, and kill the man. If corruption appear under the armhole, it is a sign the same cometh from the heart, and in that case it is expedient to bleed on the same side the sickness doth appear. Otherwise, to bleed on the contrary side bring it a double harm.
So there you have it, bloodletting. Now, I chose this extract because, to my mind, bloodletting was a rather distinctive medical practice of the medieval and early modern European world, but it's also one of which I know absolutely nothing. So could you tell us something more about this practice and its connection to epidemics?
Yeah, for sure. So phlebotomy, which is the official name for bloodletting, was the practice of opening a vein to withdraw blood in order to remove excessive or unhealthy humors. And it had a very long tradition in medicine, and early medieval guides on the subject circulated widely. As a preventative measure, such as being bled on a regular monthly or bimonthly schedule, bloodletting was meant to ensure that a person had a healthy humoral balance, and that would protect them against disease. But it was also used as a curative measure because it was believed that it would remove accumulated poison or corruption from a person's body. It was, in a way, a cure-all kind of therapy because it was believed to address just about any condition you can think of. And in fact, almost every vein in the body was associated with a specific illness. So many plague tract writers therefore recommended bloodletting because it was already a very common practice. And in this case, what they did was to recommend that the vein that would be opened would depend on where the plague bubo was located. So just as a bit of background, plague buboes tended to appear in one of three places, either in the groin, in the armpit, or on the neck under the ear. And each one of these locations in turn was associated with a particular organ in the body. So the groin with the liver, the armpit with the heart, and the neck with the brain. And so tract writers recommended selecting the veins that were most associated with those locations and those organs. John of Burgundy's tract was a bit different than most of the other plague treatises because it offered a pretty long discussion of bloodletting. And as the excerpt that you selected shows, he made the effort to explain in some detail why, how, and when bloodletting was appropriate for a plague patient and the danger that would ensue if it was not done correctly. There's actually one unique copy of John's plague treatise that took this explanation even further, and it not only turned the tract itself into a rhyming poem about bloodletting, but also included a diagram of a man marked with various plague bubo locations and the veins that should be bled in each case. This is the only image that I know of from England with this type of man in it, and the only one associated with John of Burgundy's tract. So we don't know who created the poem, but it seems likely that it was someone who either needed a bit of help remembering what to do or was teaching someone else how to do bloodletting on plague patients.
I see, and that's not something you would want to get wrong, I suppose.
No, I don't think so.
Right. I actually have a follow-up question about that. So you mentioned earlier that, you know, when talking about poultices or other remedies, and even exercise, there was a sort of practical understanding of different kinds of things that were, in fact, beneficial to the body. But does this apply to the case of bloodletting? Does this practice actually have any beneficial effect on the body that could have justified its popularity?
I think in a large part it was based on sort of the medical canon and what they had been taught about humors and corruption in the body. But there has been some recent research recently that talks about what might have been the benefits of bloodletting, and what they're finding is that fairly regular bloodletting reduces the level of iron in your blood, which we might think would be a bad thing because it could lead to anemia, but certain bacteria actually need that iron in order to replicate and cause infection in the body. So by taking that iron out of the body, they could actually have been reducing the possibility of some types of infections. There's also some sense that removing blood, especially in men who have a higher iron content in their blood than women do, it helps to prevent heart attacks and strokes and thins out the blood a little bit as well. So it seems like it did have some benefits, but not the kind of benefits that people at the time might have understood that they were seeing.
No way. That's amazing. I had no idea. It makes so much sense, though. And now, despite how interesting I find bloodletting as a medical practice, I actually need to move us along towards our next and final extract for the day. And here comes something that our most perceptive listeners might find familiar.
Some men hold an opinion that the infection of the plague engendered and proceedeth from the corrupted and infected air and vapors of the earth. It may well so be, for according as the people here on earth are diseased, so are the heavenly bodies above inclined, whereby you may by good reason perceive that of good and virtuous living cometh grace and goodness, and contrariwise of a sinful and wicked life cometh shame, sorrow and sickness, and vengeance. As appeared at the deluge of Noah's flood, when all the world was drowned for sin except 8 persons. What man living can remember that ever since was to flood in so great abomination, so supported clearly without correction as now, insomuch as it is very offensive and detestable to all good people that fear and love God? And therefore no marvel if the wrath of God be poured down from heaven upon men, and that he dare visit them with the infection of the plague and many other infirmities and miseries, since that men by their transgression do daily provoke him to anger.
As I mentioned, these last extracts bring up some familiar themes. Indeed, our listeners will be, by now, I think, accustomed to the entanglements between religion, contagion, sin, and punishment that have popped up in many of the experiences of epidemics we have covered so far in this show. But your research, Dr. Jones, into the long history of John of Burgundy's tract really brings some new insights into this question, I think at least. Could you tell us something more about it?
Yes, for sure. What I find really fascinating about the excerpt that Gaspard just read is that in its original version, John of Burgundy's plague tract said nothing about God or divine wrath or sin, not a single word. Instead, like most other 14th century tracts, it focused on astrological explanations to understand why plague outbreaks were happening. And of course, we know that to people living in the 14th century, God was responsible for everything, and it wasn't necessary to explicitly lay plague at God's feet. Religious writers certainly did, but medical writers tended to focus on non-supernatural explanations. But then, shortly before the Reformation, some tract writers started to add a religious element to their explanations of what was causing these recurrent plague outbreaks. And one of these writers, the Dominican friar that I mentioned a bit earlier, took John's tract and essentially rewrote it. In doing so, he reframed John's astrological causation of disease into one that emphasized divine punishment for mankind's general state of sinfulness. And he also used long extrapolations from the Bible to argue further for this type of moral causation. And this type of commentary was commonplace in sermons and moralizing texts, but its incorporation into what basically was a medical treatise represents a definitive shift in tone and content that completely reshaped what John had written. And I'm not clear why this friar didn't just write his own tract instead of going through the hassle of rewriting something that already existed. Of course, the friar put his own name on it, but for all intents and purposes, this was really still John of Burgundy's work. And it was this religious version that a London printer got his hands on in the late 1520s and turning it into what was essentially a bestseller during the turmoil and upheaval of the 16th century. Then, around the turn of the 17th century, so about 50-100 years later, someone took the friar's version and added even stronger Protestant language into it. And this later copy makes numerous references to an angry God, to people failing in their duty to serve their church, and so on. And it eliminated pretty much all of the astrological explanation and even some of the original medical content. So we have here a plague tract that started out with no religious message whatsoever being turned over a few centuries into one that was almost entirely about religious causation.
I see. But why do you think this interest in the connection between sin and contagion developed between the 16th and 17th centuries, at least in England, that is?
We actually see this trend across much of Europe, and it seems to have had a lot to do with the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation, even though, of course, it began a few decades before then. And it's quite interesting, actually, to see Catholic versus Protestant battle being played out on the pages of some plague treatises. The early tract writers sometimes acknowledged that divine punishment was the foremost cause of plague, but they generally did not discuss sin like contemporary religious writers did. But by 1500, the discussion of what caused the plague shifted from what were essentially scholastic medical explanations to ones rooted very firmly in religious rhetoric. And after the 1530s, we can see a really growing divide between tracts that remained largely medical and those that adopted a more obvious religious focus. From what I can see, this was at least partly due to a greater number of clerics and other religious writers who began writing plague treatises instead of just medical writers. Even those medical writers who added religious rhetoric into their tracts reflected in part their own belief system, but I'm wondering also if it was just some intuitive marketing, knowing that that's what their readers wanted to see.
Right, so they were catering to their audience in a way.
Exactly, and it is really interesting to look at the ones that almost just make passing reference and, oh yeah, by the way, God is doing this because you're sinful, versus ones who have pages after pages after pages of, you know, biblical explanations.
All right, well, thank you so much for shedding some extra light on these themes that have kept cropping up across our episodes. And once again, thank you for our conversation today. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks very much for this, Ian. I have to say that the more I study the many lives of John of Burgundy's plague tract and follow its travels across time and space, the more I become fascinated by it. There's just so much in this one document that still needs to unpack, and I look forward to the journeys that it takes me on.
And we wish you the best of luck for your continuing research into this topic. Thank you once again to Lori Jones for sharing her expertise with us. Now, to wrap up our episode, I would like to welcome my co-editor, Gashwar Yakovats, whose lovely voice you have heard reading the extracts of John of Burgundy's Plague Tract. So, Gashwar, you had a chance to listen to my conversation with Lori. What did you find intriguing about our discussion?
Many things, Ian. Bloodletting, for example. Of course, it's still practiced today, but not as a sort of panacea which would restore the balance of bodily humors in whatever situation, right? But to treat very specific illnesses, as Lori also mentioned. So I happen to have hemochromatosis, which is a genetic disorder whereby your body absorbs too much iron. The excess iron gets stored in your internal organs, which can cause serious damage, of course. So the simplest way to reduce the iron levels in your body is to drain a pint of blood out of the system at regular intervals. And these are called therapeutic venous sections, a more learned way of simply saying bloodletting, which sounds rather barbaric, right? But that's not to say that I don't sometimes feel like a patient from a medieval or early modern medical treatise.
Wow. So I had no idea. I've discovered something else about bloodletting and something else about my co-editor as well today. So do they use a specific vein for this practice?
Yeah, just veins in the surface, veins in your arms, right? Left or right. It's very similar to blood donation, right? I just have to do it on a regular basis, yeah.
Interesting. All right, as for our final question, I would like to ask you something about the transformations in John's Plague Tract, the ones which Lori spoke about at the end of her interview. You have some experience with these topics, as our listeners might remember from our first episode, actually. So what do you think?
Yeah, I was particularly struck by the substantial transformations of the John of Burgundy's tract, which occurred throughout centuries of its transcription and transmission. This podcast had by now covered various kinds of plague writing and discourses that shaped people's thinking about infectious disease in the past. And I find it always interesting to see how these different attitudes interacted and competed with each other. But what I found absolutely fascinating is how theological matter suddenly found its way into John of Burgundy's tract, particularly in the 16th century. During the social upheaval of the Reformation, the role of God and human sinfulness suddenly needed to be emphasized and almost took center stage. So, apart from telling us how the dynamics between the medical and theological discourses on plague could vary throughout history, there's also a more general lesson to be learned about the long arc of European history. Essentially, one of the points I think our listeners should take from this episode is the realization that there's no such thing as a history of a progressive, linear evolution of European societies from medieval religiosity towards modern secularism, right? Of course, this idea of progress has been long discarded by historians. In reality, things are far more complex, but we sometimes still approach the past through such reductive narratives.
Yeah, I agree. This idea of linear progress is an enduring myth, perhaps we might even say a European foundational myth, that I have also found myself struggling with from different perspectives. Thank you for bringing it up, Gashwar, and for sharing your thoughts.
Thanks, Ian.
Well, folks, we have reached the end of episode number 10 of Experiencing Epidemics. Who would have thought we would have come this far when we first started wondering how one puts together a podcast several months ago? Thank you so much to all those who have supported us throughout this adventure, and particularly to Laurie Jones and Gaspar Jakovac for their work on this episode. Now, our series still has a few more episodes in the works for you, so if you like what you've heard, look for us in a few weeks when we explore the extraordinary circumstances of a plague outbreak in late 19th century Vienna. Till next time, stay safe.